So first of all, let me just note that for any function f of x, you can represent it as a sum of cosines and sines. That's what we mean by a Fourier series. The Fourier coefficients you can relate to integrals of f of x. The formulae follow from the orthogonality properties of sines and cosines. And in fact, there are many other sets of orthogonal functions that we can use to describe functions in physics, not just sines and cosines. You can use Chebyshev polynomials and Legendre polynomials and all sorts. But Fourier series are used a lot because basically you can decompose functions in terms of frequencies. And, well, that's got a sort of meaning in physics terms as well. So certainly in analysing time series, it can be very helpful to decompose a function of time into frequency components. The Fourier series can also be written in complex form, and you may or may not have encountered this before, but this is a very powerful way to represent it because we can make use of the properties of the exponential to sometimes just tidy up the algebra a bit. So we're making use of the De Moivre notation, or is it the Euler notation, I can never remember. E to the inx is cos nx plus I sine nx. So that's probably about all I want to say about Fourier series, except to note a remark from Lord Kelvin that, in the wonderful way that Victorian scientists used to talk, that Fourier's theorem is said to furnish an indispensable instrument in the treatment of nearly every recondite question in modern physics. I had to go look up what recondite meant, but nonetheless, I think I would echo his words. He's talking about every relevant question in modern physics, and of course, modern physics isn't what it used to be, but I think Fourier series are still pretty useful these days as well. So what about Fourier transforms? Chances are you'll have met them a bit too, and effectively you can just think of them as Fourier series, but now in the continuous situation. So instead of just a discrete series of Fourier modes, we've now got an infinite number of Fourier modes. So if you have a physical process in the time domain, h of t, then you can also describe that physical process in the frequency domain by defining its Fourier transform, which is often denoted by a capital H of f. So you can think of h of t and h of f as two different representations of the same thing. The information they convey should really be equivalent. Now, there's lots of different ways in which Fourier transforms are written. Sometimes people have factors of 1 over 2 pi out front, or 1 over the square root of 2 pi. So don't get too hung up in that. But for my money, I like this one because it retains a nice symmetry in the definition of h of t and capital H of f. What we do is we define capital H of f as h of t times e to the 2 pi I ft, and then the corresponding inverse, h of t is h of f e to the minus 2 pi I ft, and in the first case you integrate over time, in the second case you integrate over frequency. And in many physical applications, we can define the angular frequency as 2 pi times f. I'm sure, again, you'll have met this before in physics courses. But I don't like that way so much because it means you've got this awkward 1 over 2 pi that comes in, which is why some people will define it in terms of a 1 over square root 2 pi, which means that you get more of a symmetry between the two. But if you just leave it as 2 pi f, then the symmetry is more or less retained. But that's just notation. That's just me being pedantic. What's more important is the properties of the Fourier transform, and this will apply regardless of whatever coefficient you happen to put out in front. The Fourier transform is a linear operation, so the sum of two functions, its Fourier transform, is just the sum of their individual Fourier transforms. All pretty basic stuff. And if h of t is a real function, then its Fourier transform is complex. And what you can do is you can define certain relationships between h of t and h of f in the case where h of t is real or possibly even or odd as defined there. So here's a little table just taken from numerical recipes that summarizes those properties. For example, if H of T is real, then H of minus F is equal to the complex conjugate of H of F, and so on for the others. So there's various things you can do to your function which will have an effect on its Fourier transform. You can scale the function in time, so you can multiply t by a, and h of at, its Fourier transform, is 1 over the modulus of a times the Fourier transform of f over a. So there's all these just useful relations that one can use to do operations on the original time domain function. You can shift in time, and you can shift in frequency, and that introduces extra factors as well. What I do want to pause just for a moment though to look at a bit more carefully is something called the convolution theorem, which is a very powerful technique in Fourier analysis, which often justifies why it really does make sense to do your analysis in Fourier space. Suppose you've got two functions, g of t and h of t, and we construct a new function, which we call its convolution, which looks like this. So you've got g of s times h of t minus s. So in physics, there'd be lots of situations where something like this would happen. For example, h of t of t minus s could be like a blurring function in an instrument, a spectrometer, something like that. So it takes g of s and it smooths it out, blurs it, like an instrumental profile, so that what you actually see is not what you want to see, g of s, but you see a convolution of g of s with the blurring function. So what you'd really like to do is to get g of s. So how are you going to do that? Well, one way to do it is to use the convolution theorem. What the convolution theorem says is that the Fourier transform of the convolution of a function is equal to the Fourier transform of the first function g times the Fourier transform of the second function h. So it's just the product of the two individual Fourier transforms. Now that's quite useful. And here's an example from astronomy. I think it's my last astronomical example, but again, there'll be similar examples from other fields that one could think of. Suppose you're looking at the spectrum of light from distant stars in a galaxy. Well, those stars in the galaxy are strung out along the line of sight, and they're all moving with different speeds. And when a star's moving with a different speed, it's experiencing a different Doppler shift, or the light that comes from that star will be Doppler shifted. So it means that the spectrum that we see is a smeared out version of the star's intrinsic spectrum, because it's moving with a different speed, and other stars at different positions along the line of sight will be moving with other speeds. So the whole thing produces a smearing that we call the line of sight velocity distribution. So that's the function we're interested in. The stellar spectrum, that's the thing that's convolved. So the convolution theorem says that the spectrum that we see, the galaxy spectrum that we see, if we take its Fourier transform, then that should be equal to the Fourier transform of the line of sight velocity distribution times the Fourier transform of the individual stellar spectra. So again, just delete the words star and velocity and all of that, and just think of these instead as measurements that are convolved with each other, and then you take the Fourier transform, and now you've got this product of individual Fourier transforms. So what you can now do is you can say that, well, the function f that maybe you're interested in, what you do is take the inverse Fourier transform of g twiddle over s twiddle. So that's the Fourier transform of g divided by the Fourier transform of f, inverse Fourier transform that, and you've got the function f back. So I put this example in because now, in the benefit of all those lectures we've gone through in the last day and a half, maybe you can see that this is fraught with danger, because the Fourier transform on the denominator, if it's very small, if it's noisy, then it will magnify the uncertainties when you take the inverse Fourier transform and try to recover f. So what you've really got to do is you've got to filter out noise, which usually will come in at high frequency. So here's a sort of picture of how that might work, just to give you an illustration. So there's the Fourier transform of G, and there's the Fourier transform of S. And if you take the ratio of the two, because it's all sort of pretty noisy up here, but sort of scratchy data, what you wind up is with these very spurious features at high frequency. So you want to filter those out. So this would be the sort of case where the stuff I've talked about before, like singular value decomposition, would be especially useful, where you can filter out the high frequency components that are just going to get magnified when you do the inversion and get back to the function you're actually interested in. So in general, what you never want to be doing is to be taking the ratio of two very small and noisy quantities, because you'll only wind up with something that's even more noisy. So you can do convolutions. You can also do what's called the correlation of two functions, and this is really just the continuous version of what we saw in the previous lecture, the autocorrelation that we worked out for the sequence of random numbers. You take a function g, you take a function h, and you take g of s plus t and h of s, multiply them together, integrate, you've got yourself a function of t, and that is what we call the correlation of g and h. And you can prove a theorem there as well. You can say that the correlation, you can show that the correlation of g and h, its Fourier transform, is equal to the Fourier transform of G times the complex conjugate of the Fourier transform of H. So the Fourier transform of the first time domain function multiplied by the complex conjugate of the Fourier transform of the second one is equal to the Fourier transform of their correlation. And if you take the correlation of a function with itself, that's the autocorrelation. So the correlation of G with G, the autocorrelation of G, is in fact the Fourier transform of G times the complex conjugate of the Fourier transform of G. Well, that's just the modulus of G of F squared. And that function is known as the power spectral density, or sometimes more loosely just as the power spectrum. People will just call it the power spectrum. So the power spectrum is the Fourier transform of the autocorrelation function for a time domain function g of t. So in analysis of spatial information, you can either do the analysis in real space and work out correlations, or you can do the analysis in frequency space and deal with the power spectrum. And certainly in my field, in astronomy, there's a lot of research goes on working in frequency space. There's also analyses that are carried out in real space, and there are pros and cons to both. So let's just end by saying just a little bit more about this power spectral density. The power spectral density is a bit like the PDF that we defined all through the course, and really right back in section one, the probability density function. So if you want to know how much power is contained in a given interval of frequency, what you do is you integrate the power spectral density over that frequency range. And the total power in a signal should be the same regardless of whether you work in the time domain or in the frequency domain. So if you integrate the modulus of h of t squared over all time, and you work out the modulus of h of s squared over all frequencies, they should be the same thing. In fact, this is just the continuous variable version of Parseval's theorem, which you might have met in undergrad lectures about Fourier series. The problem is, however, you don't always have the full range of time or the full range of frequency available to you. So although this formal equivalence of a frequency decomposition and a time decomposition is true, it's Parseval's theorem, sometimes bad things can happen if you can only sample a finite range of frequencies or a finite range of times. So that's what I want to talk about to end. It's to do with what we call aliasing. Now, sometimes we can work with just a one-sided power spectral density, and that's where you add together the frequency with its negative, and then the total power, you would just be integrating from 0 to infinity. And when h of t is a real function, then the one-sided power density, power spectral density, there's a simple relationship between that and the version we defined before. Let's not worry about that. We'll just stick with the two-sided power spectral density for what I'm going to end with, which is a brief discussion about aliasing. So, as I said, if you've got a time domain function that looks a bit weird like that, you can work out its two-sided power spectral density, and all you're really doing when you convert that to a one-sided is you're just basically folding over the contribution for negative frequencies and then adding that to the contribution for positive frequencies. So there's a couple of examples of Fourier transforms of things, and I suppose I shouldn't skate over this too quickly because this is where I think question 20 is. So let me just briefly do that. So the Fourier transform of a constant is a Dirac delta function. The Fourier transform of an e to the I f naught t, or 2 pi I f naught t, which has basically got a real and an imaginary part, the Fourier transform of that is a Dirac delta function but shifted to a particular frequency f naught. And then you can take the Fourier transform of a square, a rectangle, and that's a function called the sinc function. And the sinc function appears a lot in many areas of physics, and we're going to come back to that in just a few minutes when we talk about aliasing. You can take the Fourier transform of a triangle and you get sinc squared, the Fourier transform of an exponential decay, and that's got this rather unusual form, the real part of which is something called a Cauchy distribution, and the imaginary part is like this sort of sigmoid function. And then the last one is a Gaussian. The Fourier transform of a Gaussian is also a Gaussian. But if the Gaussian in the time domain has got the form e to the minus a half, or e to the minus a squared t squared, then in the frequency domain, it's e to the minus pi squared f squared over a squared. So if it's broad in the time domain, it will be narrow in the frequency domain, and vice versa. Which brings me to question 20. If the variance of a Gaussian is doubled in the time domain, then what will be the case in the frequency domain? Is it A, B, C, or D? Since I did skate over it very quickly, let me just look at this again. That's the relationship between the time domain function and the frequency domain function. So if the variance is doubled in the time domain, what can we say about the variance in the Fourier domain, the frequency domain? So that's your last multi-choice question. Again, I've more or less given you the answer in the next slide. The broader the Gaussian is in the time domain, then the narrower the Gaussian is in the frequency domain, and vice versa. Which does just bring me to this last topic of what you do when your data are discrete. So there's quite a lot of text in these slides. I'm not going to, given it's been a long day and a half, I'm not going to go through the details. But I want to point you towards the usefulness of not just discrete Fourier transforms, but more importantly, fast Fourier transforms, FFTs as they're known. That's the sort of second last thing I want to end with. It will lead on to a brief discussion of aliasing just after that. So a discrete Fourier transform, this is where you take a time series, which is a function h of t, but is sampled at a set of discrete points. And to simplify things, we're going to assume that they're evenly spaced. So tk is just k times delta, where delta is the spacing between the points. So we can approximate the Fourier transform not as an integral now, but just as a sum. And if you're sampling h of t at n plus 1 discrete time steps, then because of the symmetry of the Fourier transform and its inverse, it makes sense to sample h of f also at n plus 1 discrete frequencies, so that there's a one-to-one mapping between them. But this lets us see the emergence of a particularly important frequency. We call it the Nyquist or critical frequency, and we'll come back to that when we talk about aliasing. The Nyquist frequency is 1 over 2 delta, where delta is the spacing between the time domain values. So we can do some algebra. We can work out what the Fourier transform is. The delta comes out. We're just left with this sum. And because of the properties of the complex exponential, we find, in fact, that there's only n independent values, because when you go to the n plus 1 value, you're basically back where you started. So we can redefine the discrete Fourier transform as going from 0 to n minus 1, rather than, as was the case up here, it was going from n over 2, minus n over 2, to plus n over 2 with the value 0 in the middle. But you can just shift the whole thing and go from 0 to n minus 1. And you can do something similar with the discrete inverse Fourier transform, which recovers the h of k's from the capital H of n's. Again, it's just a sum. And there's discrete analogues to the convolution and correlation theorems as well, which I won't bore you with. So how does that lead on to fast Fourier transforms? Well, because we've reduced the whole thing to just a sum of terms, either equally spaced in time or equally spaced in frequency, then there's some very elegant symmetry relations that we can take advantage of. So if you look at the formula for the discrete Fourier transform, what that says is it's basically a sum of terms which are coefficients linearly combined together with data values. So these W, N, K values are just, you know, e to the 2 pi I k n over capital N. You change this value of small, rather, you change the value of k, and you get different terms, but they're all just complex exponentials. And it's actually a matrix equation. So what you're doing is you're taking an n times 1 vector of h of n's, and you're constructing that by multiplying the vector of data, n by 1 h of k values, by an n by n matrix. Now in general, that's going to require n squared multiplications, which is fine if n is small, but if n is quite large, let's say 10 to the 8, 10 to the 16 calculations, even if a computer can perform a billion multiplications per second, which probably looked quite impressive in 2006, maybe not so impressive these days, but you don't want to have to wait 115 days to calculate your Fourier transform. So how can we speed things up? Well, what you do is you assume that n is an even number. And what that lets you do is take the sum from 0 to n minus 1 and split it into two halves. And because of the symmetry relations, you can basically rewrite the second half in a form which makes it look very much like the first half. The only difference is this W to the n that's sticking out front. So you've turned the Fourier transform with n points into the weighted sum of two Fourier transforms, each of which has got n over 2 points. So that should reduce the computing time by a factor of 2, because you've got n squared on the one hand, and you've got 2 times n over 2 squared, which is n squared over 2. But why stop there? If n, which was n over 2, if that is also even, then you can do the same again. So in other words, if n is a power of 2, like 1024, 2048, and so on, then you can perform the splitting as a sequence. And each time you reduce the number of computations you have to carry out by a factor of 2. The final step in that iteration involves computing Fourier transforms involving only one element. So, well, that's easy. That's just one single calculation. So the Fourier transform of each discretely sampled data value is just the data value itself. So what we've done is we've turned an n squared process into an n log 2 n process. So our 10 to the 16 operations are now only about 3 times 10 to the 9 operations. So instead of it taking 115 days, it's only going to take about 3 seconds. So doing FFTs, it's, you know, one of those ideas that lots of people around the time this was first introduced were probably kicking themselves, saying, why didn't I think of that? It's a beautifully simple and elegant idea. And you might have done FFTs already. You might have never had to bother thinking about how they work. But I think it's worth just pointing out that this is a very good example of where data analysis is now routinely possible, that just a generation or two ago, it would have been completely impossible. And sometimes it's because the computers got faster, but other times it's just because the people writing the algorithms got smarter. And there's a value in doing both. So let me just end then by saying a very few words about data acquisition and aliasing. So all of this stuff I've just done very quickly, going through the ideas about discrete Fourier transforms and fast Fourier transforms, is all about replacing a continuous function by a discretely sampled function. And you might think, well, maybe that's not a good idea. Do I really want to throw data away? Do I want to just sample data at a set of discretely sampled intervals? But in fact, if h of t has got the right form, and h of f has got the right form, then there can be no loss of information whatsoever, which is quite nice. So what we're going to do to end is just say a few words about under what conditions, if you sample h of t discretely, you can still determine h of t exactly, even at all the intervening points, because what you can do is interpolate. And it crucially depends on what information there is at high frequencies. If the power spectrum is zero at high frequencies, then you can safely reconstruct in between the discrete samples. And this tells you what the minimum sampling rate is to achieve this exact reconstruction. And then the flip side is, if your data acquisition doesn't achieve that minimum sampling rate, then what's going to go wrong? So this involves something called the Nyquist-Shannon sampling theorem, which sounds a lot more complicated than it really is. Because all it's really saying is the following. It's saying that if you've got a function which is bandwidth limited, that means that its Fourier transform possesses the following property. There's a certain critical frequency such that the Fourier transform is zero for all frequencies outside that range. Provided that condition is satisfied, then the Nyquist-Shannon sampling theorem says that you only need to sample h of t at a discrete set of values in order to be able to reconstruct h of t perfectly, even at the intervening values. So provided your sampling interval delta satisfies delta equals 1 over 2 fc, that critical frequency, or less, then you can exactly reconstruct h of t even just from the discrete samples. And in fact, the general form of reconstruction involves the sync function that we defined earlier. So f of c is known as the Nyquist frequency, and delta to the minus 1, 2fc, is known as the Nyquist rate. So h of t is the sum of the sampled values weighted by this sync function, scaled so that its zeros lie where the sampled values are. So it does seem a bit counterintuitive. You think, how can I possibly know what's going on with this function h of t in between the values I've sampled? But it's because you're dealing with a function where there's no power at high frequencies, and it's just a question of where that critical cutoff frequency is. And provided you then sample HFT sufficiently finely, then you can indeed reconstruct perfectly what HFT is doing in between your samples. So it's a very powerful result. The sync functions allow you to interpolate the center on the sample points and allow you to fill in the gaps in the data. And they can do that job perfectly, provided HFT is indeed bandwidth limited. Now, formally, you do need to have an infinite number of discretely sampled values, but if you only sample them over a finite time interval, then the interpolation isn't perfect, but it's usually still extremely good. So, for example, if you just sampled this sine curve at the red points, then you can reconstruct the values exactly in between for all values of t with no loss of information. And that's because, by definition, the sine curve, because it's only got one frequency, is bandwidth limited. There's no contribution to the power spectrum for frequencies larger than that. So what's the downside? It's to do with aliasing. If HFT isn't bandwidth limited, or if you don't sample frequently enough to hit this Nyquist rate, then your reconstruction of HFT and HFF is going to be badly affected. So that means that the power in the power spectral density, the power spectrum, the power that lies outside the range from minus FC to FC is going to sort of pollute your data. It's going to be spuriously moved inside the range so that the Fourier transform you get will be computed incorrectly. So any frequency component outside the range is translated into that range, and we say aliased into that range. So here's just a simple pictorial example. So we've got this sort of irregular function h of t, which looks like this. It's sampled at intervals delta, and its Fourier transform might look like this, and the Nyquist frequency corresponds to the vertical lines as shown. So there is a contribution to the power spectrum outside the critical frequencies, both at negative and positive ends. So what the aliasing does is it takes that contribution and folds it back inside so that the Fourier transform that you would actually get is aliased. It's systematically larger than it should be because we haven't sampled the data finely enough. So your computed value of H of S at the critical frequency is actually twice the true value, which is not such a good thing. But fortunately, it's quite easy to fix, because if you enforce some chosen F of C by filtering H of T, then what you're doing is you're actually forcibly removing high frequency components. It's a bit like what we did with the galaxy spectrum example. We just filter those out on the grounds that they're probably just noise. And that can be a very good way also to compress the data set. And although I don't really know the details very well myself, my understanding is that this is the kind of approach that things like MP3 algorithms use to compress music, to compress sound. So you're throwing away the high frequency information that only dogs would hear, but fortunately the human ear can still hear the music perfectly well. So that's one way to do it. You just filter out the high frequencies, or what you do is you just increase the sampling rate so that you exceed the required frequency. So if you do the filtering, then the second step will just guarantee that aliasing won't be a problem. And if you don't do the pre-filtering step, then what you can do is something broadly similar, which is fix your sampling interval and check whether the Fourier transform is approaching zero as you get to the corresponding limiting frequency. And if it isn't, then you're potentially in trouble, because the contribution to the Fourier transform from outside that frequency range will be aliasing your result. So you just increase the sampling rate, do the whole thing again, and then see whether your Fourier transform is indeed tending to zero at the limiting frequency. So all is not lost. It's usually possible to get round aliasing quite straightforwardly. Finally, let me say a word about the mock data challenge. This is more for the benefit of the PGT students that will be watching the videos in the week to come. But if you guys do want to try this, you're more than welcome to. What I've done is I've generated some fake data. And believe me, if you're a physicist for your entire career, you'll probably never see data as good as this. What I wanted to do was to generate a data set where you could just tell almost by eye what the answer should be. And then you can see whether all the methods that we've talked about in this day and a half actually give you the answer that you expect. So the first thing is the easy part, is just using the formulae for ordinary least squares to fit the straight line and the intercept of these data. The second part is to do that analysis but as a maximum likelihood problem, for what you're trying to do is to construct Bayesian credible regions for the model parameters by assuming a bivariate normal model for the likelihood function describing these data. And then the third part of the data challenge is to write an MCMC code to sample from that likelihood function and similarly to get credible regions for the model parameters. So I won't say any more about it now because I've got a longer description of the three stages which I'll put on my.supa. As I said, it's entirely optional anyway, but if anyone who's a supergrad student does want to have a go at this, you're most welcome. But for the PGT students, the taught master students, this is a compulsory element of their assessment.